Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. Great performances begin with a comfortable close shave from Gillette. Gillette, making men's lives just that little bit easier.
Game on 2FM with Gillette. When we show our best side, we don't just play the game, we change it. Gillette, made of what matters.
Game on 2FM.
Thanks a million to Jenny Green for keeping us bopping along. It's Monday, the 20th of April, and this is Game On.
Coming up today, we catch up with ex-Liverpool, Real Madrid and England star Michael Owen.
This is Owen, taken in his stride. Chamot trying not to bring him down. It's still Michael Owen. He's scored a wonderful goal. Is there nothing beyond this 18-year-old?
We take a look at the opening episodes of The Last Dance as famous voices dissect the career of Michael Jordan.
But suddenly you have a sports figure that puts Chicago on the map and that everybody was able to rally around.
Plus, we've Kerry football hero Tommy Walsh, and we'll hear from the Donaghers as the Do It For Dan campaign passes the €1 million mark.
Game on 2FM.
Super stoked, we want to hear from you. You can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM. Marie, Ruby, how are we doing?
Cool, Donica, yourself?
Yeah, I'm good. Sunny day in Cork, so always happy, Ruby.
I had a great weekend, lads. I found some sport, a new sport I'd never seen before. It was called petanque, and I went to the local park and there was a guy practicing it, and he actually put on a demonstration for the family and explained it all to us. It's absolutely super. It's like bowls. I'm sure he'll probably hate me for saying that if he's listening, because it's probably really different.
It's probably hate the bowls.
Yeah. But it was great, and like, he was telling me all about the league that they have, and he'd represented Ireland and how we're doing on the world stage. It was an education. And I also figured out that if sport does come back, petanque is probably a sport they'll be able to play, because you can get your own jack and you can have a partner, but you can stay apart. So I think I've it sorted, lads. Don't worry.
Can we go right back to the start? So this man's out playing, minding his own business.
Oh, yeah. And we rocked up, sat down.
What are you doing?
And he rose to the occasion. He could have, you know, toned it down a little bit, but he started like getting really into it, came over, like stayed far enough away, explained what he was doing, told us all about the sport, and just then, like, there's a little hula hoop that you step into, so the kids loved it, and put down the little ball and then threw the big ball at it, and we were loving it, cheering and everything. And other people came along, stayed a safe distance away, but it was great.
You salvaged it well there, Marie. The other people stayed well enough away. You were just starting to walk yourself into a corner there.
Social distancing was kept to a paramount.
We were very good at that.
Yeah, it is.
Anyone else get up to anything exciting?
No, but I'm actually so glad for you. You needed that for the sport.
Actually don't think you'll be able to top it. I'm so smug right now.
Well, what's the sport called again?
Petanque.
Petanque. Any experts in petanque, please leave us know. 51552. We'd love to hear more about the game.
There's a few teams in Dublin, and there's a good few in Belfast as well. And there's a league, an All-Ireland league.
Are you going to get involved?
Well, I asked him about that. He was trying to recruit us. The youngest member is 18 and the oldest is 90. So, like, he said it's actually a really good sport to get into now, because you can play it for the rest of your life.
What did your lads make of it?
Yeah, they liked it, because you were throwing things and you were standing in a hula hoop. I mean, what else do you want?
Hopping it off each other.
It's good fun.
I'd say they'd really enjoy that after a week or two. No contacts. I'd say it really suits your lads, Marie.
Oh, they'd love that, yeah. I mean, they're such low-key guys, you know.
Ruby, yeah. Did you get up 10
of them? See it already. No, same old, Donica. Another Groundhog Day weekend.
You're
riding ponies.
Bit of a green fingers, though, aren't you?
There's no grass left.
Yeah.
No grass left.
It's like Forrest Gump on
decided
that
to. No, I've decided now to pull down bramble bushes. That's my latest hobby.
You are a spiky gentleman for taking that on. I'd say the brambles are like...
And the hands are cut off me, so they are.
I can imagine the brambles going, it's all right, Ruby, we'll make our own way. It's fine, we're on our way.
Did everybody do their homework and watch The Last Dance?
Yeah.
You better have watched it, guys.
Yeah,
Michael Jordan documentary,
on. We did. It's wrong to kind of call it homework, though, isn't it? Because you enjoy it. So, like, you know what I mean?
Well, on Friday you did say you were more looking forward to watching that dating show.
Too hot handled, did you see it?
No, of course I didn't.
Ruby, are you watching Too Hot to Handle?
I can't believe you even asked me that.
Okay. Have you watched Tiger King?
No.
Do you know what's brilliant? Is because The Last Dance is out now and people are talking about it, we don't have to hear about Too Hot to Handle and Tiger King anymore.
Do you
There's
know what
a new viral sensation.
Okay, I totally agree with that. But I would pay money to have the two of you watch both those shows, Tiger King and Too Hot to Handle, on, you know, like...
How much are you paying?
The Ruby Walsh ultimate line.
We have a punter.
No, it's the quickest way to end the conversation, because I know too well, being a rugby player, he ain't going to put his hand in his pocket. Yeah, so that's the end of the conversation.
Notoriously tight. I give it €3. €3. Scratch your own side of the coach.
End of. Back to The Last Dance.
So for anyone that doesn't know what The Last Dance is, it's a 10-part docuseries about the rise of Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls. And it specifically looks at the 1997-1998 season when they won their sixth NBA championship. But it goes through all of Michael Jordan's career from when he started playing basketball as a kid and right through his college career and the draft. And then it kind of meets in the middle with the Last Dance season, as it was dubbed. And everybody has been raving about it. It's absolutely fantastic. For me, I just love that even though it's like nostalgia and it's old, I almost forgot what the ending is going to be. And, you know, I was so sucked into it because of all the characters and the storylines that it actually felt like I was watching something that was completely new. And it was brilliant as well because it was just so much basketball in it, just so much of the skill that Michael Jordan possesses, just seeing that old footage of him in college. We're only two episodes in, but just absolutely loved it. Ruby?
But to watch him in the 84-85 season when he started with the Chicago Bulls and how he had to earn his stripes and how he never gave up and got going. But then it shows him in 97 in Paris where he wouldn't sign the autograph for the guy that gave him the microphone. And you're thinking, how did that guy get from there to there?
And how do you think he did, Ruby?
I don't know. It was just interesting. I mean, he was standing, I could understand people in crowds, and I watched Tiger Woods and I understood why he didn't sign autographs, because if he stopped, he was never going to get moving again. But this was one guy in a corridor putting a microphone on him that asked him to sign something, and he didn't even say no. He waited for the guy behind him to step in and say, no, he's not doing that. And I was thinking, wow, that was really early in the show. And then it showed him in 84, 85, how he had to work his way into the team. And you're thinking, they're two different people. Mm.
I love that he came into a poor culture dressing room. So the Bulls, like, were misfits. They didn't look after themselves. They partied. And as a young fella coming into that environment, you can easily fall in and accept the standards around you, whereas he absolutely changed it.
I was actually really surprised that there was a drugs culture when he joined the Bulls and that he spoke about it. We have that clip here.
I had one event. Preseason, I think we were in Peoria. It's in a hotel. So I'm trying to find my teammates. So I start knocking on doors. I get to this one door, and I knock on the door, and I can hear someone says, shh, someone's outside. And then you hear this deep voice says, who is it? I says, MJ. And then they all say, oh, he's just a rookie. Don't worry about it. So they open up the door. I walk in, and practically the whole team was in there. And it was like things I've never seen in my life. You know, as a young kid, you got your lines over here. You got your weed smokers over here. You got your women over here. So the first thing I said, look, man, you know, I'm out, you know, cause all I can think about, if they come and raid this place right about now, I am just as guilty as everybody else that's in this room.
It's a funny one. When I have that argument now about drug culture and the society we're living in, all I get told is that it's all around people. They have no choice. It's all around them. And there you have someone who had a choice and made the right one. Mm. So it was there before. And unfortunately, drugs have crept back into society more so again in recent years. Michael Jordan was able to say no. More people should be able to.
That's a very good point, and it's actually a very valuable clip for people, younger people who might be starting off going out or hanging out with their friends to see that and even to hear you say that, Ruby, because people don't say that anymore. They make excuses.
That's the answer I get the whole time. When I say it, people say, oh, you don't understand. You're a different generation. It's all around you. It's everywhere. Michael Jordan stared it in the face and said no. So the next person that gives me that answer, I have an answer for them.
Do you know what as well? Just in three of us, obviously, parents, it shows the importance of actually setting good values. And it, like, he's a young, impressionable man there going into a dressing room full of probably heroes, you know, like that he would have looked up to and tried to aspire to be like. And to walk out the door and go, they're actually, you know what I mean, they're not at my level. And straight away, like in the doc, he's saying, I'm going after the alpha, I'm going after the main man in the dressing room. He wanted to be it straight away and he wanted to change the culture.
Well, he wanted to succeed. And when you look into something and you realise what the opposition is, they were the guys he had to be better than. And I'd say he thought it wasn't going to be too hard to be better than them.
Mm, yeah. I did get a giggle out of his parking. Did you see how he parked before he went training at all? He drove a really nice car, I don't know what it was, something very smart, and just abandoned it and jumped out and walked in. Like, I suppose when you're Michael Jordan, you can leave your car wherever you want. No one's really going to give out to him, but...
I think Balotelli did that. The soccer player as well, he got a load of parking tickets, so he left it there. I don't think he ever collected it somewhere in Manchester, I think. Let's look that one up.
Yeah.
Text us 51552. Who was the famous footballer that abandoned his very expensive car and got loads of tickets on it and was just left there for months? What was great as well for me was that there was so much time and space given to all the different characters and personalities. So we got such a broad view of not just Michael Jordan, but everything that comes with being on that team. So whether it was what was going on in the boardroom and on the business side of things, but also the other players. And like, I heard of Scottie Pippen, and when I went to see the Bulls, he was there and they paraded him out, and, you know, such a huge part of that whole story and legacy. But I don't think I appreciated how important he was to the dynamic of the team. And, you know, he's been called the Robin, but it seems he's actually a lot more than just a Robin, that without him, I don't know how well Jordan would have functioned over those years on the court. And to just to hear how little he was paid compared to everybody else and how that was playing out as well, I just found that fascinating.
But the proof was there, Murray. I mean, Michael Jordan joined in 84. It was 90 before they won anything. And lo and behold, Scottie Pippen came along. So what were they without him? Well, they weren't winners.
But wasn't it mad that he was tied into that contract and that, you know, it wasn't, that it was let go like that?
But the thing on that, Murray, like, he obviously... Like, he goes into it. His brother was in a wheelchair. His dad was in a wheelchair. He needed a long-term contract. So when they offered it to him, and people do that with young, talented players, you try to get them for as long as you can, for as little as you can. You see the potential, and you try to lock him into a big contract, well, a long-term contract, because you know he's going to pay it out. But when you've good people in your environment, you should reward it. And I think, you know, that became a massive stumbling block within that team. And... It's nuts to hear the, what is it, Jerry Cruz, is that the general manager? Like, he doesn't get a whole lot of credit, and they were giving him an awful lot of a hard time on the bus. But he did get Scottie Pippen into that team. He did get, you know, the trade with Seattle. He was a smart man.
Oh, he was, but you see the reception when he walked out in at the beginning, at the start of the 97 season. Like, where the crowd nearly boo him onto the court and they clap everybody else. I mean, talk about... Not being loved in your environment, but that was his job. And I mean, to secure Scottie Pippen into the contract that he did was good business by him.
Yeah.
This wasn't very nice, though. I just found it just uncomfortable that he would have to get to a stage where he would get an operation in season rather than, as he said himself, mess up his whole summer. What I loved about it as well was that you see this team dynamic, almost a dynasty. And you look at sport now and it's so much about individuals. I think Klopp is doing something special with moulding the players that he's got into a team. But it's so hard to get those teams now together and to get them to stay together and to be dominant for so long, because sport is so full at that level with all that money at the top level. I mean, it's so full of individuals. So, as you said, Jerry does get a hard time, but credit to him for keeping that together at that time.
Because that, when you look at it, Michael Jordan in 84, out of college, going in with the attitude he had, how he knew he was at the bottom, he knew he didn't have a voice, and he knew he had dirty stripes. How many players go in as teenagers now thinking they're at the bottom? They go in on big contracts thinking they're already at the top. Is that the difference in a team dynamic? Is that the difference in how you make a team?
Yeah.
Don't know, Ruby.
Don't look at you played in the team. If you lads come out of the academy and they're too big for their boots, what did the other lads think?
Yeah, and you actually see it in this doc. You see, is it Charles Oakley, just when Scottie Pippen comes in, and it's something I hate and I'd never stand for, but you see him clipping him. And that was the kind of mindset probably within that dressing room, that you've to earn it. And we chatted about Jordan. He certainly did go out and grab it. But Pippen, when you look at the stats, they roll up one of the stats. He was second on rebounds, second in scores, and then ahead on everything that makes just a good teammate, kind of like assists, steals, stuff like that. I just think it's unbelievable how they had a brilliant dynamic in their team. That Dennis Rodman, they said, no ego, well, knew with the egos in the squad that he could survive without the ball.
It's a bit like you and Paul O'Connell.
Stop it. It's nowhere close.
We got a text in as well. It was Mario Balotelli, £10,000 in fines, and his car was impounded 27 times.
Wow.
And not worried about paying fines then?
Not bothered.
No.
Just bought a new car. Incredible.
Yeah.
Do you know the other thing then that I found fascinating, a lot of things I found fascinating this, was that he was able to go through his career as well without really tarnishing the brand. So, we see brand's been so important now to footballers, and to be able to build up that Jordan brand and to make it almost bigger than the game in ways what he had, and to keep it going now, so far beyond his playing days, that he is still so relevant to the sport. And, you know, going to a basketball club now, all the kids are wearing Jordans. It's amazing. And as he said, what did he say? There's no I in team, but there's an I in win.
Well, there is a me in team, if you look at it. But I wonder how much they'll go into the 93 season and his mysterious retirement. When I did look, googling, as you said, our homework, Marie, I was looking into that and the mystery that still surrounds that first retirement. I wonder in the next episodes, will we see a different side to that story?
No spoilers, please.
Isn't it mad the way Netflix normally give you a binge all you want, but then they've held us back here with something we're really into to just watch too, you know? You could watch as many Too Hot Handles as you like, but...
Okay, let's take a quick break.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. As Donica alluded to at the top of the show, today is the 20th of April, so yesterday was the 19th, and when we look back through history during the week to try and find content for this show, we realised that on the 19th of April 2001, Liverpool beat Barcelona in the UEFA Cup semi-final to qualify for their first final since they've been banned from European football after the Heysel disaster. So I rooted around to see what we could find, and we've been joined on the line by Michael Owen.
Didn't have to root too hard, did you?
No, so back into my WhatsApp, went back to middle of March and I found your number.
Careful now.
So I did. Anyway, Michael Owen, that was a vintage time for you in Liverpool. You won the League Cup, the UEFA Cup and the FA Cup. And it was a time, I'm sure, you really enjoyed.
It was. I mean, standout year, I think, for the throughout my career when I look back. I mean, had other successes. But that year to win, I mean, you mentioned three there. But I think there was another two, so the Super Cup and the Charity Shield we won as well. So when we were doing our team picture, we were smiling away with five trophies in front of us, which is pretty unheard of at the time. And of course, we had success as well, international. We qualified for the World Cup and we beat Germany 5-1 in Munich. So it was just a brilliant year that rounded off in style.
I know Liverpool is a very emotive club and has had a lot of tragedy in its history, but to get back into a European final after what had happened in Heysel, it must have meant a lot for the club.
It did. I mean, Liverpool, of course, see itself as a part of European fabric, really, the history of the game and huge European nights. So there had been a big delay, of course. You mentioned, obviously, the Heysel disaster. And then, of course, we went through a period as well where we just weren't good enough, basically, to be competing at the highest level. And we were sort of, when I first got into the team, we were coming, you know, sixth, seventh, fourth, fifth. You know, it was we just weren't there. And then gradually, Gerard Houllier took over. We started winning a bit of silverware. And then, of course, the rest is history, from Benitez then taking the club on to Champions League glory, and as I say, it's all sort of forgotten in many ways now because you look at the success of the first team. But no, I mean, it was that time when we were starved of success, and that was the first real bit of success we'd had for quite a while.
Michael, we're just talking about Michael Jordan there and big stars of sport. Sport back then, it didn't get bigger than you when it came to big stars of football. What was life like for you?
Well, life changed quite quickly for me, Marie. In a way, it was. I wasn't one of these players that got better with age. That were late developer or anything else like that. I was pretty much, at the top early on, and even as a kid, as under 15 or whatever it was, playing for my national team and breaking all the goal scoring records, I'd say, right the way through youth. So I was that player that people all knew about. I mean, obviously, if it was today as social media and everything else, it'd be probably more of a hullabaloo about somebody about to make their debut. But I think my career was quite the opposite to a lot of players, whereas I hit the heights early and then gradually fizzled out due to injuries and things like that. So coming back from the World Cup in 98 when I was 18, and obviously the whole world talking about me at that point was different. When I look back now, I think, wow, that's weird, because you don't see that happening. You don't see young kids doing that. But at the time, it just felt normal. It was just, that's what I do. That's what I've always done. I've always scored goals like the one I scored against Argentina. It was just a normal thing, really. It's only now I look back and think, maybe it wasn't too normal.
When you're a star, though, and you're doing so well and scoring the goals and like fulfilling your dreams, are you able to enjoy those? Were you able to enjoy those moments?
It's a good question, that, because I think when you're in it, of course you enjoy. You know, Ruby will tell you, you cross the line in a big race. Of course, there is enjoyment, but I think part of it, in the back of your mind, that the enjoyment goes really quickly. You love it for the moment, that adrenaline rush. But if you're competing at the very, very highest level, and you know, just being third or fourth is standard, then I get it. But if you're trying, like I won the Golden Boot in my first year as a 17/18-year-old in the Premier League, and then retained it as an 18/19-year-old. So, for example, all of a sudden, that trophy is mine. I'm the Golden Boot winner. I've done it in the first 2 years of my career, and I don't want to end. So every time I come off the pitch, be like, yes, I've scored two. Oh, no, Shearer scored three. Or, oh, no, Ruud van Nistelrooy or Thierry Henry or all these. And I'm so it's a constant fight, really. It's almost like you're on a hamster wheel, that even though you have a little bit of success, you're always saying, oh, no, someone else has. And, again, I relate it to Ruby or someone like Tony McCoy, that I can't imagine when they're travelling 4 or 5 hours up to Scotland to ride a winner at Perth and they're enjoying that. But the fear of somebody else taking your crown is sort of what drives you on. So I think at the start of my career, yes, enjoyed it. But then the pain of feeling my career slipping away and not being elite anymore, that was quite hard mentally.
It's that fear of failure that's always sitting in the background. And you won a Ballon d'Or in 2001. And when you look at Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo racking them up now, do you think, yeah, I did that too?
Oh, well, of course, yeah. I point to it most nights to the kids. It's one of those awards, Ruby, that, they just don't grow on trees, do they? Once in a year, you know, there's a vote for who's the best player on the planet in that particular year. So, as you say, I think they've won it, I think it's about 10 or 11 times between them now. I think it's 11, 6 for Messi, 5 for Ronaldo. So they basically dominated it for the last decade or so. But obviously before that, there were some great players that used to fight out for it. You know, the original Ronaldo and Zidane's and players like that. I mean, there were some great players before these two came onto the scene and literally dominated football. And yeah, I mean, to put my name alongside all of those. And as I say, we had a great year. We touched on it before. I mean, 5 trophies, success internationally. And that just rounded the year off for me, really.
Michael, when you're sitting at home watching games or in the studio on TV analysing them, particularly Liverpool, do you look at that current team now and ever wonder where you'd fit in and how you'd do?
I suppose so, a little bit. The way Liverpool play now is just unbelievable, isn't it? It's just, it must be so good being an attacking player in that team. The game has changed, or let's not say the game, let's say how Liverpool are playing at the moment is different to how they were playing back in my day. And in fact, most teams are a bit different to how they used to play. I mean, it was unheard of not to play with two strikers back in the day. But now it's pretty rare. I'd say only two or three teams in the Premier League actually play with two out-and-out strikers at the same time. So they're playing in a not a strange style, because it's quite a common thing that they're doing, but the way they play and the way their fullbacks are used as attacking players, and their midfield three are more of a structure to the team. They're sort of the anchor of the team, and then you've got the front three, the blistering pace and guile, and they've just got a bit of everything, and they work so well together. Jurgen Klopp's just done an unbelievable job at that place.
You have blistering pace, or you had blistering pace anyway. Who would you take out of that front three to put yourself in for?
Oh, wow. Do you know that's been a good argument or good debate for a year or so now? Because I remember when Coutinho left and everyone was saying, well, actually, it's probably best him going, because Sadio Mane was actually playing brilliant at the time. Then Mo Salah came along and he was just tearing it up. And then everybody started appreciating Firmino a little bit more. And then Sadio Mane's come back and now he's just gone on to another level again. So at different points, I'd say, he's the most important and he's the most important. At the minute, I would probably say Mane is the most important of the three if I had to pick one. But, I mean, we're splitting hairs. In terms of me, similarities, are certainly not that similar to Firmino, but possibly more similar to maybe a Salah or something. Obviously a goal scorer with pace, not great height. So yeah, probably that. But we are splitting hairs. They're three unbelievable players.
That's a polite way of saying you're short, but anyway, not great height. I must remember that one for the future. But obviously, look, we all know the situation we're in and the current climate in the world, but look, it was about to be the end of a long wait for Liverpool. Can you see any resumption for the Premiership? When can you see them being crowned champions?
I can. I think, obviously, it's going to be government-led. And, of course, the main priority in all of this is the health of people and the population and everything else. So football does come a long way second. But we are all excited for, lives to resume and the day-to-day things to continue again. And of course, football is a major part in so many people's lives. I think, as I say, it'll be directed by the government, but I think that the Premier League will do absolutely all they can to try to get the season finished. It might take a little few twists that are quite unprecedented, that I'm talking about maybe a certain venue that all the games are being played at, certainly going to be behind closed doors. Maybe the teams are going to be on lockdown for a few weeks. Who knows? But I think they're going to do absolutely everything to get it concluded, because it's the ramifications, if it's not, are a complex, to say the least. So I think they'll try. But of course, the longer it drags on, the less and less likely it will be.
Another part of your life since your retirement has been Manor House Stables, which Tom Dascombe is in. How are all your horses looking at the minute?
They're all looking great, but unfortunately they can't earn us anything at the minute. They're shine, their coat's great. Obviously this weather at the moment is bringing them forward probably quicker than you would hope or expect. We've got 80, 90 horses in training in Cheshire. I started Manor House about 15 or 16 years ago, and it's gradually built to something to be pretty proud of now. And we've had success at the top level. Of course, one of my great moments was coming over to Ireland to win the Irish St. Ledger with Brown Panther. It's a huge part of my life, football and racing. And it's, again, it's another frustration that we can't quite kickstart the season. And again, it's going to be one of those, isn't it? Once the season starts, I guess there'll be certain rules, regulations. So, crowds can't go for the early part of the season, maybe. But anyway, it's, as I say, bigger, more important things than that at the moment. But yeah, we're all eager to start the season.
Michael, it's amazing your transition from soccer has been to horses, from one sport to nearly the complete opposite. What kind of got you into it? And, just What did you take from the winning environments that you'd been in, the likes of Liverpool, Real Madrid, Man United? Is there stuff you saw there that you thought, you know what, if we brought that along to the horse world, maybe that could cross over?
Yeah, I think to start with, I mean, I used to be play on a Saturday morning. My dad used to come watch me, and on the way home after our game on a Saturday morning, he would stop off at the bookies on the way home and have 50p on three horses. And back in those days, there was no sport on the television. So, you get a bit of skiing on a Sunday, you get match of the day at night maybe, and you get racing on a Saturday afternoon. But really, there wasn't that much sport at all. So I used to sit there in the afternoon watching my dad's horses that he'd just picked. And that sort of got me interested. Then I would read the paper and see what trainers and jockeys were in all. And then eventually ask my dad if I could pick one of his horses. And of course, that just spirals. And then as soon as I'm 16, 17, asking my dad, can you walk into the bookies, Dad, and put a pound or two on for me? Because I wasn't old enough at the time. And then as soon as I came into a bit of money after when I was 18, of course, had the ability to buy a horse. I bought my first two and sent them to John Gosden. And then that basically just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And then at a point at about 24, 25, I thought to myself, this is going to be part of my life forever. I loved it. And I thought, I want to build my own place because it's expensive having 7-8 horses in training every month. So I thought, I'm going to build my own place and hopefully lean on some of my contacts to have a few horses. And that's where the idea started. And there are, of course, there's so many crossovers with football. I've gone through the whole cycle, I think. It started off, I enjoyed having a bet right at the start, which is probably what got me into it. But then I started really loving the medical side of it, probably linking to a few of the injuries that I used to get. But I had an empathy, a feel for how it felt to run hard, to be stiff after, what feed, why we giving them that feed. I loved talking to the vets, and I was just a sponge for information. And then it goes full circle, then the social side of things now and having friends there. It's just a great sport.
So when did Ruby Walsh come on your radar for the first time? Do you have a distinctive memory of him?
Well, of course, Ruby's always been on the radar for me. I mean, as much as I went into to flat racing, I probably only went into flat racing because as soon as football season finishes, it's obviously you get your summer off. So that's probably why I ended up buying a horse for the summer so I could go and watch it. But I've got great passion and respect for both codes. And of course, Ruby's been at the top of his tree for many, many years. So, and then I guess just mixing in those circles. I've known Tony McCoy, Mick Fitzgerald for a long time. So I guess mixing in those types of circles, going to Cheltenham, going to Aintree, I can't exactly remember the exact date, but I feel as if I've known Ruby for quite a while.
He has that effect on people.
Oh, thanks, Marie. Well, I'm missing Chester as much as you're missing Chester right now, Michael, but thanks a million for taking our call, and look after yourself.
Yeah, good to speak to you. Thanks very much.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. If you've just joined us, you just missed Michael Owen, and you can hear it back on our podcast, which you can get anywhere you get your podcast, and even on Spotify, which Marie surely has downloaded by now.
I didn't do it. I'll do it today.
Ruby, have you Spotify?
Of course I do, Donica. I've all those mod cons.
Fair play to you, Ruby. You rattled your black book, and you landed us a right one there, Michael Owen. It's great to hear.
Funny enough, Donica, I'd say it's nearly your turn to start rattling your black book there.
Yeah, okay. Who'll I get? Flannery, like? Don't hang around.
Just think
the
of someone.
Circle,
come on now. You're on. How many Lions tours are we on?
It's on two.
And you forgot your phone, or didn't take anybody's phone number, or fell out with everyone, or
I was too busy.
But too busy that watching that show that I can't remember the name of, and I'm thrilled that I can't remember the name of it. Don't
too,
say it.
Too hot.
The more than she wrote.
Would you take him? Would you take Salah out and put him in though? 51552. Let us know. Would you replace Salah
an 18-year-old Michael Owen, definitely.
Hold on. Michael the main Owen. Question is, would you crow?
No, not right now.
You wouldn't.
No,
you
it's just it's going
he's
so
only
well.
Off the phone.
Why would you? Yeah, I hope he's not listening. it's going too well. Like you just leave well enough alone for now. I mean, we might bring him on, like with a couple of minutes to go.
It's amazing, though, for such a young guy, like, to have that success straight. And with us going down the route with Stephen Kenny of guys coming through and into the game, you wonder, you know, throw guys in, give them an opportunity, leave them score wonder girls.
He said himself, though, like, at that time, he was the biggest thing ever. Like, he was sensational. If we had social media, as he said, that, like, they would have been making the biggest deal out of him ever. I think we can't even overstate the talent that he had as a kid, and also the impact that he made all the way up through underage as well. He was, as I had asked him, on the radar. He was on everybody's radar. Now, guys, can we turn our attention to GAA? Because we're all watching and waiting and hoping that there will be some GAA. For many people, I think they're just wondering how Tommy Walsh will be getting on with the advance mark. I know that's wishful thinking because we have nothing at the moment. But sure, look, why not say it anyway? And I'm thrilled to say Tommy Walsh joins us on the line. Tommy, how are you?
Very good, Marie. How are you?
We're great. We were chatting to Michael Owen there now, so Ruby's happy. So once Ruby's happy, we're all happy.
No pressure, Tommy.
Tommy, you don't realise the abuse I get on this show. I just can't wait for RTE to open up properly so I can go to HR and make a complaint.
You're well able for it, I'm sure, Ruby.
You're not wrong.
Hanging in there.
So, Tommy, we don't have any football, but we do have plenty to talk about. And I think with you in particular, the last couple of years have been quite interesting just in terms of you reinventing yourself again and kind of getting that of momentum back. And I'd imagine, have you got a love of football, like almost a renewed love of football again?
I suppose you could say that, yeah. I had, when I came back from Australia, I was back playing with Kerry pretty much straight away. And I suppose for a number of factors, things just didn't go my way. So I called it quits for a couple of years. And look, I was delighted to get an opportunity to come back in last year. And we just fell short of the final hurdle to a great Dublin team. So, I enjoyed last year. I enjoyed the start of this year. So, obviously, this is very unexpected what's going on at the moment. But as you said there, hopefully at some stage this year, we can get back out in the field again. But obviously, everything needs to be safe for the players and the spectators and everything like that. So, it's just a huge unknown at the moment. So, we're just doing what we can, trying to keep fit and listen to the experts. And hopefully, things will come back online later in the year.
Tommy, obviously, in the first All-Ireland final match last year, you had the Dubs on the ropes for a lot of it, maybe not so much in the replay, but did you feel you had the scope you needed to make that little bit of improvement that was needed?
Yeah, we did. Look, I think we missed a lot of opportunities. Our accuracy in both games is probably a bit off. We missed a lot of chances, and had we taken any of them, we probably would have won the game. So it's, when you're playing against a team like that, they're not only are they so, they're obviously very experienced, but they're very talented as well. So when you do get the chance, you need to bury them. And unfortunately, we didn't do that in the first game. We probably had chances in the second game also, but just didn't take them. And in the last probably 5 or 10 minutes, they just kind of ran over us. So there's learning in that in itself. We've tried to improve a number of things and tried to implement them early this year. But look, I suppose it's hard to tell whether we'd even get the chance to come up against them again this year. And look, there's other teams as well. We're obviously not the only team that's trying to get over Dublin, but hopefully we'll get the chance to have a crack off them again.
It must be very enjoyable, Tommy, to be part of a team that plays such exciting football, and especially in the forwards, because you're the team that everybody looks to for that exciting attacking brand of football, and to be part of that and be part of kind of that special wave coming through, it must be really enjoyable.
It is, yeah, and look, I suppose particularly I'm obviously one of the older guys, but to see the younger guys that are coming through now and the talent that they have, the likes of, you know, the David Clifford, Sean O'Shea, Killian Spillane, those type of guys, they're all wonderful footballers, and just to see them develop even over the last 12 months when I've been involved has been really enjoyable. And to get the chance to run out the field with them it has been exciting. And even when I'm finished, I'm sure I'll get a lot of enjoyment watching those guys over the next 10 to 15 years.
Tommy, there is exciting football, but with Kerry, it's about winning, isn't it? Do you feel that pressure to get there and to win? You know, it's been a long while now.
Yeah, it has. Look, I think in Kerry, the expectation is always, to try and win the All-Ireland. And any year that you don't win it is a bad year. Last year there was a lot of positivity towards the team. There probably was improvements maybe from the previous couple of years. But we got to the final. We didn't get there, and that's the bottom line. Like you're judged on how you performed the summer, We had our chances in the All-Ireland final and didn't take them. So you just have to learn from it, get back, train harder, try and develop as much as you can, and be a better player for the next season. As I said earlier, we tried to implement a couple of things this year. There's a couple of new guys on the squad that have come in and made a difference. So, you know, we just, things are on hold at the moment, but if they do get back, you know, we just have to try and make that extra step, and, you know, hopefully we can.
Obviously, Tommy, as you said, things are on hold, but, like, from your experience playing in the AFL, do you think as the year progresses and things get tighter, how quickly could GAA players turn around? Week in, week out, every 10 days, 12 days? How often could you play matches?
I think you could play every week. You know, I think, like you see during the National League, where you're playing week in, week out, and that's probably the most enjoyable time of the year when you are playing those games every week, because, you know, you're coming in during the week. You know, everyone's getting ready for a game. There's a good buzz around the place. Training is more football-based rather than, you know, conditioning-based, and that's obviously more enjoyable as well. So, you know, I think, obviously, look, there's more scope for injuries and things like that, but I think with the way modern Gaelic footballers are now, you know, they prepare better than ever, they recover better than ever, and I think if there was ever, I suppose, a time when GAA players could cope to playing more games in a shorter period of time, it would be now. So, and obviously, look, if it does get back and they're going to try and squeeze fixtures in, that's the way it's going to have to be. But, you know, certainly from my perspective, I would enjoy playing week in, week out.
And just in terms of the next few months, because it looks like it's going to be at the very earliest July, if at all, that we get to see any Gaelic games this year. For managers, do you think that players should be allowed to take a break for a while now and then maybe try and get back into it when a date is announced?
Yeah, well, look, I think initially probably training was, you know, like any other county, you know, you get a program, you go away and try and stick to it as best you can. But I suppose when we realised that it was going to be longer, you might scale it back a bit. You know, taking a break is probably the wrong word. I don't think anybody takes a break during the year. Guys are always tipping away. So, you know, and I think that's going to be the case for the next couple of weeks. It is obviously a lot harder to train by yourself than it is with a group. But guys have their programs. They're training away individually, doing what they can, and you know, hopefully when we do get the call or a date that there is going to be games, or even that training is going to start again, that guys are ready and they can get back quickly and up to game speed pretty much straight away, and that's the way it's going to have to be, because when they do make the call, you know, I can see the games coming ticking fast.
Tommy, myself and Ruby chat about it a lot, the kind of overtraining and the load that's put on certain players. You've seen it from both sides, as a pro over with St Kilda's and the Sydney Swans. What level are GAA amateurs training at? Like, is it at the level as pros?
It's probably the time commitment that makes it probably that bit more difficult than it would be from the professional setup. Like, the training in a professional environment is, in my opinion, is a bit harder, because, you know, you've got more time, the trainings are longer, you know, there's more expected of you. But when you're trying to juggle study, a job, you know, family life, travel, different things like that, plus your intercounty training schedule, that actually makes it very difficult. There's a lot more balls in the air, and that's probably something I struggled to adapt to when I came back. I was used to being a full-time footballer. That was all I had to do every day, was focus on being ready for training, recovering after, and getting ready for the next session. Whereas now you have, you know, I was living up in Cork, I was travelling down to Kerry, I was, you know, you're in the car, you've work and all that as well. So it is actually more difficult. While the training mightn't be as hard, it is actually more difficult to be a GAA player than to be a full-time pro.
Well, on that note, Tommy, we are going to leave it because we are out of time. But thanks so much for joining us, and we do look forward to hopefully seeing a bit of Gaelic football later in the summer.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks very much.
Tommy, so, you don't know who won the lotto down there,
Tommy.
Do you?
No, it's one of the Healy Rays was on about it today. It wasn't him, was it?
I don't know. 9.7 million, the lotto in Kerry, lads.
Thanks, Tommy. Talk to you soon. Now, I think everyone in the whole country this weekend has heard about the Do It For Dan campaign, because there has been a massive amount of fundraising going on for a little boy from Laois. His parents are Niall and Aisling Donoghue. They're both former intercounty Laois footballers, and they're trying to raise €2.1 million to save his life. And I'm delighted to say that we are joined on the line by his dad, Niall Donoghue, former Laois footballer. Niall, how are you?
Well, Marie, how are you?
Oh, I'm great. More importantly, how's Dan?
Dan's in great form. I forgot to see him today, but I'm after seeing a few pictures of him there today, so he's smiling away as usual. But no, he's in top form, in fairness to him.
Will you tell us a little bit about
Dan? It's amazing
Dan?
To hear you.
Sorry,
Niall. Will you tell us a little bit about Dan and his condition?
Dan was diagnosed with SMA, spinal muscular atrophy, on the 6th of December. So it's, just simple terms, it's muscle wasting disease. So before Dan was diagnosed, when he was 3 or 4 months of age, like, he was the same, as able to do most things that every other child was able to do. Get up on his elbows and look around and lift his legs, anything that you expect. But he shortly got sick with tonsillitis, and literally from there it just went downhill for him. He lost everything from that day forward, and to the day he got diagnosed, he just had lost all them things, and then got diagnosed with SMA on the 6th of December. So it's a horrific disease, really.
It's amazing to listen to you speaking in such upbeat terms about something that is so hard on you all in your lives. And have you been surprised, delighted with the efforts people are making in a fundraising sense?
It's unbelievable what's going on at the moment. Like, as I said before, myself and Aisling, we knew this drug was out there as a possibility for Dan, but the two of us would have never ever thought of raising 2.1 million. Like, it just doesn't seem possible. So, like, the committee and their friends, family, everyone that came on board to do this so far, like, it's just dreams coming true, really, at the moment. Like, it's what's going on around the country. I just couldn't even single out one certain thing. It's unbelievable. And look, it's driving us forward. Like, you know, it's putting us in great humour. It's the stuff we're seeing. Dan's after giving everyone, I think, a positive outlook on life at the moment. Things I've seen over the weekend, the spirit, community spirit. I had people contacting me from clubs saying it's after bringing their club back together, people that had kind of gone away from it, and that, like, you know, it's amazing what's gone on the last few weeks. Like,
it's amazing, Niall, without knowing him, but you just see the smile on his face on your posts. What are the biggest challenges facing Dan now at the moment?
Well, at the moment, I suppose, like, for us, I suppose, well, COVID-19 is a challenge, I suppose, for everyone, but Dan faces probably them challenges every day. Like, a simple chest infection could end it for Dan. Like, that's the scary reality of it, and we had a scare like that before Christmas, where we just had to rush him into hospital, where his breathing had dropped below 70 and his heart rate, like, was up over 200. Like, just a simple chest infection that had come on over 2 days. So simple colds, even his swallow with Teden now, it'd give you frights at night, because he doesn't have a strong swallow. So Dan swallowing at night, it nearly sounds like he's choking sometimes. Like, so, like, it's the poor little fella has lots going on, but for all the stuff he's going on, even the treatment he gets at the moment, which is a lumbar puncture, an injection into his spine, like, he cries maybe for 10 or 15 seconds, but once he's back out, then he's all smiles again. Like, you know, he's just an amazing little fella. Like,
now, the pictures and the videos of him, I think they're giving everyone a lift. And I also think just people watching on and seeing how much communities are coming together to support Dan during this time, and just the fact that the virus is going on and we can't go out, it's still managing to unite people and give them a lift. I know that there's a memorabilia auction going on. Like, I saw Gooch and Starr raising money, Henry Shefflin, Joe Canning, Leighton Glynn, Andy Moore and Sean O, Ken McGrath. They're all giving sporting memorabilia to raise money for little Dan. I think, Ruby, you're going to give something, are you?
I'm going to go look for a proper pair of breeches now, Marie. Just any old pair is not going
to
do, is it?
And Donica?
Yeah, absolutely. Whatever's needed there, Niall, we'd be delighted to help.
And we're so thrilled that you're almost there. You've broken the million.
How can people at home help?
Yeah, the million was broken yesterday. So, look, it's like we're overwhelmed by it. We'll never be able to thank people enough, like from all around. It's literally all around the world. And like work colleagues, just everything. We'll never be able to thank people enough, but what they're doing for Dan is amazing. And look, I think there's more stuff going on as the weeks go on. And I think it's going to happen for him, like, which is just, it's life-changing for us, and just it'll be a dream come true if we're getting on that plane to get him that treatment.
Well, now we're all behind Jenny. We're going to tweet out the link to the GoFundMe page, and we wish you the best of luck, and to your wife, Aisling, as well, and baby Dan. Thanks so much for joining us. Guys, that is all we have time for. Ruby, do you have anyone coming back or coming up tomorrow? Any friends that you've called in?
Well, funny enough, it's the 21st tomorrow, so 7 years ago, Graham McDowell won the RBC Heritage Open, so we got him. Marie, who'd you get?
I'm going to bring along Dr. Con Murphy. I had to get the wedding invite list out and say, right, who was at the wedding that I haven't called in a favour for ages?
Donica?
Okay, I'll get my finger out and call someone.
Game on 2FM.